NBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. For this week's transition episode, I'm joined by a man who, after decades of work as a state trooper, a detective, and a consultant for multiple federal agencies, shifted his focus to using technology for crime solving. He's taken the concept of crowdsourcing to a whole new level. If you listen to True Crime Binge, then you heard Morgan chat about his podcast, Game of Crimes. But today, he's here to talk about a new technology that he's patented and is hoping to bring to market soon. Please welcome Morgan Wright.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Ford Ranger, a vehicle for all terrains and every passion. It's a workmate, a playmate, and to its drivers, a soulmate. So how do you improve the Ford Ranger? You go all in. The all-new Ford Ranger, the UK's best-selling pickup. Now available with rear bumper steps, tailgate workbench, and enlarged load box that can fit a Euro pallet. Go break it in. Search all-new Ford Ranger. Ford Pro. Driving productivity. According to SMMT data, features may be optional extras with additional cost.
All right, I'm joined today by Morgan Wright, who those of you who listen to both True Crime Binge and Truth and Justice heard him on last week's episode of True Crime Binge with his co-host of the Game of Crimes podcasts, Steve Murphy. And in that show, we were discussing more about their podcast and the story of the takedown of Pablo Escobar. So if you're interested in that, you should definitely check out last week's episode of True Crime Binge. But during that conversation, Morgan mentioned to me that he owns a patent on some software that has to do with crowdsourcing. And given that the entire nature of the Truth and Justice podcast is for us to do crowdsourcing, not to mention the fact, Morgan, that I just watched the show Clickbait with my wife this week.
Oh,
wow. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And they were using some sort of crowdsourcing software in that show. And I thought, I wonder if that's based on what Morgan's put together. So are you familiar with the show, or do you know anything about that, or do they rip you off?
Yeah, and no, I haven't got around to it. I mean, but no, I've watched a preview of it and stuff, and it's just, but you know, people are, there is nothing people won't do, you know, whether it's like Clickbait or the catfishing one, you know, that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say this, you know, I'm a huge Notre Dame fan. I did my graduate work there. Manti Te'o, catfished big time by a girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Notre Dame, so I live 10 minutes from the Notre Dame campus. I'm just right across the border. Huge Irish fan. Big win over Florida State this weekend.
Oh, freaking nail biter, dude. There wasn't enough alcohol for me to get through that night. And it's like, well, I grew up in a little town called Mishawaka, just right outside of South Bend there.
Yeah, that's my neighbor. So you know, I'm sure you grew up in Mishawaka?
Yeah, well, I'd say grew up like a year and a half. My dad taught ROTC at Notre Dame during the Vietnam era, and I met Joe Theismann before he changed his name to Theismann for Heisman. Yeah, so but I've been back several times. Like I said, did my graduate work there, and I just love the campus. Yeah, but Sunday night, that sucked. I'm going, now give kudos to Florida State, man. They hung in there, but it exposed. We actually have a pretty good offense. Our defense still needs some work because that front three just got run over left and right.
Right. I was watching, it was driving me nuts all night, and I was the same as you. The stress in the overtime was about killed me. But yeah, so I live in Niles, so just. I mean, right. I mean, I shopping. My wife was just in Mishawaka today shopping.
Oh, so no kidding.
Yeah, same stomping grounds. So, I guess first of all, for people who haven't listened to the True Crime Binge, can tell people a little bit about yourself, your background with the state police and in law enforcement, prior to doing the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, sure. No, just the real quick synopsis. 18-year state and local law enforcement, police officer, state trooper in Kansas, detective. I ended up having working on some fun cases with federal partners, everything from big drug seizures to counterfeit money cases to bank robberies, you know, with the FBI to homicides and everything. So got a full range of stuff. But one of the areas I specialized in was serial crime profiling, behavior analysis, interview and interrogation. So I had the chance to go get training by the FBI. I had a chance to get trained by the original members of the FBI's behavioral science unit. One of them was a guy called William Peters. And he was one of the first people in the BSU. And so from this, I was able to, you know, stay focused on this, had the chance to take a big leap. You know, most people stay and they retire, they, you know, law enforcement, and then you retire on 55% of what you couldn't afford to live on in the first place. And I said,
right.
Yeah. You know how it is, you know, working for the city, for the state and stuff. So it's like, so I took a huge chance, moved out here to Virginia and started doing a lot of work in the defense and intelligence area. So a lot of my work was, especially around, How can we apply technology to solve big mission problems? And before 9/11, I was in Colombia, working on Plan Colombia, working on some very pretty cool things on seized asset management. How do you derive intelligence out of the assets that are seized? And then 9/11 happened. Of course, that changed everything. So a lot of stuff was what was called joint counterintelligence field activity, the counterintelligence field activity, joint counterintelligence assessment group. There was stuff with, I was there when DHS was stood up after the Office of Homeland Security. Got to participate in some pretty cool things. And a lot of the work I did, like at the Department of Justice, and this is where I really started diving into figuring out how information is shared, where it resides, and where the flaws in and how they do it. So I ran a big project called the Law Enforcement Information Sharing Program. It's now called OneDOJ, but it was the strategy for how does the Department of Justice share information with 18,000 federal, tribal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. And, you know, they were just approaching it wrong. I think we did some really cool stuff. And out of this, but out of the work I did in the intelligence community and right before DOJ, we actually came up with some stuff that we actually went out and briefed the FBI around on the DC sniper case. And it was, you know, everybody was looking for a white panel van, but the problem was it's not a white panel van. Yeah. So you start looking for the number of people that have contact with law enforcement, age 16 or older, you boil that down to how many have 2, 3, 4, 5 contacts. So one of the things I told him, I said, it's the way serial killers work. If you want to catch serial killers, they usually have low levels contacts with police all over the place for everything. You know, it could be traffic offenses. It could be drunk in public. It could be, some low level offense. So what you do is there's a system called VICAP, Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. So when you submit homicides and information about dead bodies that you find, things like that into this system. One of the things it does, it looks at and say, are there similar things in terms of tradecraft? Are there similar things in terms of MO, you know, and the signature? You know, what things can we say could connect these cases together? And I said, then what you do is you draw big circles around those. And then you go back into systems that the government has. I won't bore, you know, the listeners with technical terms, but the main system is called NCIC, the National Crime Information Center. Well, Bob, every time you if you were a cop and you were checking me out, you stopped me at a traffic stop, you check to see if I'm wanted, you check my cars, it makes an entry into an offline log. Well, nobody was ever mining that offline log. And I said, go back, look at this NCIC offline system, draw circles around this, around where all the shootings were happening in DC. Well, when you did that, you went back, you found out that only 97 vehicles in the National Capital Region had their license plate checked by police 2 or more times. Out of those 97, 3 were Chevy Caprice, and out of those, or 3 were Chevy Caprice, 1 belonged to Malvo and Muhammad. So in other words, people were solving, and this gets into what we're going to talk about in a minute. My philosophy was, everybody's trying to look for a needle in a haystack. I said, you're doing it wrong. If you spend all your time making the haystack smaller, it's a waste of time. You use a bigger magnet. That's how you pull information out. You don't go making the haystack smaller. You design systems and approaches to make a bigger magnet, and you pull the information out. So that's what got me into, you know, doing all of this.
It's so interesting. And if we can back up a little bit back, like after 9/11, I'm very familiar with what you're talking about. I was a fireman when 9/11 happened. And what we found, everything changed after that for the fire service, obviously for the police service. And the biggest thing, for your listeners that don't understand, one thing that was identified at 9/11 where all these agencies came in together at that time, we found out one thing that affected me personally was the incident management system that was being used
Yep, NIMS didn't exist
at that
point.
NIMS came out of that.
Right.
And it was because everyone had a different management system with different terms, with different... And so when all these agencies came together, it was a mess trying to organize. So the incident management system is the system we use to organize personnel, strategies, and tactics on a fire scene, on any kind of incident.
Any incident, yeah. Use it. Right.
Yeah. And then out of that, there became this big effort. I wasn't aware of the technological effort on the law enforcement side. I taught NIMS all over the country after that once that happened, because we learned that we need to all get on the same page. We need to share information. We need to use the same systems. It was a big push for everyone in the emergency services to learn that we needed to have some sort of unity in our procedures. Yep. And so but on the law enforcement side, so you were working on information sharing. Is that I understand that right?
Yeah, information and intelligence sharing. And then also one of the biggest things we found was at one point there were 25 separate terrorist watch lists. So for example, out of the 19 hijackers, 6 of the 19 hijackers had prior contact with law enforcement. Give you an example of one, Nawaf al-Hazmi was stopped in April of 2001 by the Oklahoma Highway Patrol and written a traffic ticket. And he paid his mm-hmm. ticket, right? He was put on a State Department watch list in August of 2001. Well, the problem with that, you put somebody on a watch list who's already in the country, you're never going to catch him because you're looking for people to come in the country. At that point, Nawaf al-Hazmi was already in the country. Him and Mohammed Atta were two of the key planners for the cells that were operating in the United States. If you'd been able to find one, you might have been able to pull enough threads to unravel this plot that was going on. The other thing, too, is Mohammed Atta was stopped in July by deputies in one county, not knowing that he had a warrant for his arrest in another county. Why? Because a suspended driver's license. And plus, he'd overstayed his visa. Nobody checked his through the system to find out that he had overstayed his visa. Had they done that, the main person, Mohammed Atta, would have been arrested at that time by INS for overstaying his student visa.
So was the issue that they thought these people were outside of the country and were looking for them to come in? And
no, Nawaf al-Hazmi for sure, but with some of them, they really did not connect the dots in time. I mean, you had the Phoenix memo from the FBI agent talking about the people taking flight school. You had the issue with Zacharias Moussaoui, who was the 20th hijacker, and they could not get a warrant to search his computer, even though evidence was clearly on there. And so, there were a lot of issues. And actually, some of the work I did at DOJ was preparing materials for the attorney general and the deputy attorney general. John Ashcroft was the attorney general. James Comey was what's called the DAG, the deputy attorney general. But the biggest lesson that came out of 9/11 was failure of imagination. And that's kind of took that lesson to heart. So when I started looking at other stuff, which led me into the patent and the other stuff, I started saying, I just started looking at it. I go, people are doing this all wrong. They're sharing information all wrong. Give you one quick example of how we redefined the way we thought about doing stuff. Because in the government, they're like saying, well, you can't share that information. You can't share that. We need to come up with a list of all the information you can't share. And I said, impossible. I just can't do it. I mean, information could change. I said, you guys are thinking about this wrong. Instead, what we should do is define what information we can't share, not what information we can share. What information we can't. So there were only 8 things that we couldn't share. By when they finally figured out only 8 classes of information we couldn't share, by default, mm-hmm. that meant if it didn't fall into one of those 8 classes, the decision was made. You could share the information. That was a much easier, cleaner way than trying to say, well, let's figure out all the types of information, that we could share and determine whether we can or not. Did you know there's an art theft database, that the FBI manages? No. Yeah. I mean, how do you account for all of this? So it just... They made it a bigger problem than what it needed to be. In other words, I just kept going back. What's the bigger magnet? What can we do to pull the information out quicker, faster, better, more efficiently?
How does any of that stuff that you're talking about, the information sharing, does any of that relate back to like the NSA stuff with, wow, how am I drawing a blank?
Snowden?
The guy's name. Yeah, Snowden. Yeah, with that information. Was that a separate issue entity from the things that he was exposing?
That's separate. What he had provided information on were classified programs about how the NSA does collection of data and some of their programs to tap into fiber optic lines, in data centers and stuff. So, however, though, one of the things you do is one of the areas I taught when I taught out of the NSA was the damage assessment agents are a particular type of person that comes in. They're not there to investigate the crime. Anytime when something like that happens, it now becomes the province of the FBI. The FBI does the investigation on all counterintelligence and intelligence, and investigations like Snowden. However, though, the NSA or the CIA or whoever whoever was the affected agency, they have what they call damage assessment agents. They do their own investigation to determine a couple of things. Number one, how did the person get access to the information? And number two, mm-hmm. what kind of damage was done to the United States by the release of that information? That's why they're called damage assessment agents. And so we had so many people relying on the polygraph, they were starting to lose their people skills. And like I said, you know, we said in the previous episode, you know, an interviewer armed with case facts, both utilizing both verbal and nonverbal behavior, can correctly assess truthful or deceptive behavior 93% of the time. That's more accurate than a polygraph, which is judged to be around 85 to 87% of the time. So, you know, a person properly trained does a better job than a piece of machinery, but people were relying on the machinery too much. And that's what allowed people like Aldridge Ames to pass the polygraph, because he made friends with the polygrapher. You know, he did some other stuff and he got the benefit of the doubt. So, oh, by the way, with the episode we just released, we were talking about with Gary Ridgway and the Green River Killer. We did a Facebook Live last night with Dave Reichert, the investigator. Gary Ridgway passed the polygraph. People say, well, see, the polygraph failed. No, polygraph did exactly what it was supposed to do. Gary Ridgway is a sociopath. He feels nothing. He feels nothing mm-hmm. about killing 49 women. You are not going to get somebody like him to register on a polygraph.
Right. That's so interesting. And then so you worked on all this information sharing through technology, and then you took that another step, and that's the part that really mm-hmm. really intrigues me, is you've taken it into a space where it can be utilized for crowdsourcing. So mm-hmm. can you talk about what it is, this product that you've patented, and what does it do?
So the premise was, when I got out of my last corporate job, I was laid off January 30th, 2012, after I had to lay off a bunch of people. I almost went to jail over that too. So I was working for a French company, and they were going to lay everybody off at Christmas. And I said, I will come over to France and I will kick everybody's ass. I have no problem doing time in a French prison. Wine, three hots in a cot. I'll do time anyway. But so when I got out, I had some time to think about it. And this is really something I wanted to get into, because prior to that, I'd been a technical advisor for America's Most Wanted. And it all started by me writing a blog post called MS-13 Was a Clear and Present Danger, got picked up by Sean McGuinn, an associate producer. And from there, it blossomed into things to where I actually worked with John Walsh and his crew on. And one of the things I designed was a solution that says, how can we get information into the hands of the public quicker, faster, better? Because in the old days, when you called into America's Most Wanted, 1-800-CRIME-TV, they had U.S. Marshals in the call center. People say, well, that should be fine. No, the problem was, all of the calls that went outbound from there were all anonymous numbers. So even if I was the U.S. Marshal, you know, Deputy U.S. Marshal, and I was calling you, Bob, and you were, you know, a law enforcement agency, you can't trust me. I mean, it's like, well, how do I know this is true? You know, so they'd have to go right. to their National Operations Center, send a teletype, say so-and-so is going to call you. So that just created, you know, a bigger loop that you had to process to be able to get that. So I said, let's use a trusted system. So we used a system called Inlets. It's now called the International Justice and Public Safety Information Sharing Network, but it connects all 30,000 law enforcement agencies. Homeland Security uses it to put out Homeland Security alerts. So we said, we'll just put America's Most Wanted on there as a node. So when the message comes out, the message will come from a trusted system, which is the Inlets network. They will have an identifier called an originating agency number, and it will get shot out to the agency that, and they can trust it right away. So the reason we designed that was, again, it was about how do you get information out quicker, faster, better. Well, on the 1000th episode, like I said, I'll send you the link. You know, we got it. It started working, but then the show changed. As you guys know, the 1000th episode was kind of, I don't want to say jump the shark for AMW, but you could see the beginning of the end for them at that point. And so then they went mm-hmm. to the Lifetime Network, and then then they did a reboot. It only went for 5 episodes. You know, with Elizabeth Vargas, Jim Clemente was on there, you know, mm-hmm. Paul Holes, right? Yeah. So anyway, the reason I said all that context to say, what frustrated me was that I said, everybody's approaching this wrong. So after my corporate job, I had some time to think. I actually thought about this while I was on vacation in Mexico for 10 days in Cancun. It is glorious, comrade, when you can sit down there after about day 3 and you realize, I don't care what day it is. I just get up when I get up. I drink when I drink, right. You know. But I started thinking about what connects us all. And what connects us all are basically 5 things: date, location, time, demographics, relation. So you and I, if we sat back and we kind of, because the world used to be 6 degrees of separation. Remember that old game, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Yeah.
Well, with Facebook, with social media, it hit me and said, the world is connected by 3.47 degrees of separation. In other words, you're 3.5 handshakes away from Vladimir Putin or the Green River Killer or Kim Jong-un. You know, that's how close we're. So I got to thinking. So it got me thinking about all the different cases and the way they were trying to solve it. And what they were doing is they were putting information out there and hoping somebody would read that information, which is kind of the essence of crowdsourcing, and then react. So, but I said, but that's wrong. You guys got, again, it goes back, you guys are doing this wrong. You can put it out on Facebook all you want, but unless somebody has a connection to that case, they have, I mean, how do you connect with somebody who has no connection to what you're sharing? And so, but the thing is, think about this. Has there ever been a homicide around where you live?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you're connected at least by date, location, time. You were probably in the same area on the date, at the same, you know, around the same location, maybe at the same time, right? Have you ever known anybody who's been a victim of a robbery? You know, have you ever known who's been a victim of burglary? So we start looking at, what are relations? Did you go to high school with somebody? You know, how many people went to high school with Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer? A ton of people, you know?
Right.
How many people worked at the Kenworth plant with him? A lot of people, right? So we started looking at the, I started looking at the connections and I said, you know who's doing this right? It was actually Facebook. Have you ever gone onto Facebook and gotten a friend request from somebody? You emailed them on a completely separate system, but it says, hey, Bob, you may know so-and-so.
Oh, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, and it got me thinking, well, guess what? What I should do is create a case, take an active case, and create basically a shadow profile for that case and find out how many people have connections to that case. Were you in the same location around the same date at the same time? Do you know the person? Do you know the area? Have you ever visited the area? So all of the things that Facebook used to connect us together on, instead of me connecting to you, I just made you the case. And I said, can I connect to the case instead? That's why the original name of this, or still the name of it, it's called Connected to the Case. And so what we did is I got a couple friends of mine. We built the first system, and it was really based on Facebook. So you would log in with Facebook, or you would agree to share your information through Facebook with it. And so one of the things we did is we said, Facebook's got this right. They know the fields. They know how to connect us based on those things. And what were they connecting us on? Where we went to school, where we lived, where we went on vacation at, where we took a picture at and tagged it. I was in Ocean City, Maryland. Well, so was I. Now we have a connection. So we piloted this with the Loudoun County Sheriff's Office, and they had a fugitive they'd been looking for 6 months by the name of Cleon Williams. And Cleon hates me because I put his case out there and he says, well, I didn't do it. I said, I don't care if you did it or not. You got a warrant for your arrest. You are wanted, you know, by law enforcement. And this guy used to be a cop. This guy was a Leesburg police officer, but he had had arrests, felony convictions for everything from weapons to other stuff. But they'd been looking for him for 6 months and they couldn't find him. So what I said, hey, give me only the publicly available information, a flyer. I don't need anything else. In fact, if you just give me his name, I'll do the rest of the work. So they gave me his name, and I went through with open source stuff, found everything on the web, and I just created a profile for him. But once you put it into the system, then it's like DNA. It's social DNA. What is it that he has that everybody can connect to? Because if you go to a crime scene and I find DNA, I analyze the DNA, I get the markers, you know, and now I have a DNA profile that goes into a system called CODIS, the Combined DNA Information System. So when I have a unknown, now I arrest somebody, and I take their DNA and I run it through the system, you get a hit. Why? Because now I have an unknown sample being compared to a known sample. They're the same, and now I have a connection. Well, social DNA works the same way. So we found this guy in 36 hours that they'd been looking for 6 months. And the reason was I found out all the places this guy had lived, you know, from New Jersey through Philadelphia here into Leesburg and Loudoun County, and I put those in as locations. People came in and they would share their Facebook information. They say, well, I've lived in Leesburg and I've lived in Philadelphia. Well, what it was, a lady in Philadelphia sent a tip in and said, hey, I know this guy. In fact, he just tried to scam me and do this. Here's where he's living. She was connected because she was connected to our site. She got a notification that says, I'll just make up a name. And it's like, Lisa, you may be connected to this case because you and Cleon Williams both say you're from Philadelphia. Now I've created a real connection between the person with the information and the person I need information about, and that's how we connected people together. The flaw in traditional crowdsourcing is you throw it out there and you hope somebody will look at it. It's like sending somebody to a website of missing people and say, scroll through the 18,000 missing people and see if you recognize anybody. As opposed to,
right,
where are you from? Where have you been? What's your date, location, time, demographics, relation? And I will serve you up every case that you have a connection to. Now I've raised the probability that you actually have a connection to the case, and that you can actually provide information as opposed to, Virginia State Police, God love them. I love my state troopers. I love my state police. But all of their unsolved homicides are basically nothing but one big Google Doc. And I have to scroll through there and look at pictures and where did this happen? And it's like, how many people are going to take the time? We live in a day and age to where now it needs to be mobile-based. I need to have a mobile app that says, hey, guess what? Bob, you may be connected to this case. Why? Because you were in Florida, in Miami, Florida, during August of 2018. And by the way, we had a homicide not too far from where you were at. You know, do you happen to know anything about this case? You would not have known about that case otherwise, because you would have gone back to Michigan there. You would have been happy in your life, you know, and you would have never known anything about that case. But the connection you have to that case is you were both at the same place at the same time.
So how, when you were doing it in that almost demo, it sounds like, with Loudoun County, so you said you connected somebody in Philadelphia. Were you actually using the methodology through Facebook, or did you have some sort of user interface that was out there that people were using to connect?
So we can't do it anymore because of the way Facebook does it. But actually what it did is when you would come in, you would agree to say, hey, I'll log in with my Facebook account. And we would say, hey, we want to pull all this information. You would say, sure. So we'd pull from your Facebook profile and populate a database with it. And then when we put a case in there, we'd populate the fields with the same data that Facebook would collect, like date, location, time, demographics, relation, you know, where have you lived, where have you worked, where have you gone to school, where have you gone on vacation, you know. So we would collect the same information, and all we would do is compare it together. The problem with Facebook and what we ran into, and this is why it stalled for a while, I had to revise it and change the way I did it, which is why I got the patent on it this time, was Facebook could change their algorithm tomorrow and then it would break everything in the system. So we had to come up with a way that says, how can you collect information one time? And so that's why the actual patent name is called Computer Implemented System and Methods for Generating Crime Solving Information by Connecting Private User Information and Law Enforcement Information. Now, private user information, it's a technical term for the patent. It doesn't mean I need your social security number or date of birth. It means you are a private user. You are basically a citizen, an individual. Because see, the great thing about this too, Bob, that gets past all the privacy problems, I need no date of birth. I need no social security number. I need no height, weight, hair and eye color, scars, marks, tattoos. I don't need any of that stuff to solve. I need five things: date, location, time, demographics, and relation. That's it.
That's it. And so in that case, what were you calling them? The connected to the case. So were people going on that website or that app and then connecting their Facebook to it. So people were just voluntarily, kind of like people who voluntarily put their DNA into these genealogy.
GEDmatch, you know, and Ancestry 123. Yeah, absolutely. And you would, I mean, some people would say, well, what are you going to do with this? Nothing. We're not going to market. I mean, this is really what we're trying to build a, basically what it is was a crowdsourced crime fighting solution, but it was crowdsourced from the standpoint of we were making actual connections. We just weren't saying, come to our site and, you know, we'll throw up a ton of cases to you. Because after, if you get 100 cases, Bob, and you have no connection to them, what's the chance you're going to look at the 101st case? Yeah, just you start getting fatigue, right? But if you get a notification and the only cases we're asking you to look at are the ones where we can show you have a connection to this case because of these five things, you know, you were here at the same time, you went to school with that same person, you worked at the same place and went to college at the same place. Now you go, now I have a real connection. It may be a third level, a fourth level connection, or a second, or it's like LinkedIn, right? How are we connected? Well, sure. I know of somebody who knows somebody.
That's really interesting. And now that's slightly different than, if I'm understanding right, what you were talking about back when you were on the 1,000th episode of America's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
When you were sending information to the police. That to me, when you were describing that to me, that almost sounded like, as far as the secure nature of transferring that data, it sounds like blockchain technology, like what cryptocurrencies are based on. When you were talking about the nodes and the instant transfer and the confirmation of where they came through. Is it similar to that? Are you familiar with what blockchain technology is?
No, I'm very familiar with it. And really, it's transitive. So blockchain is built on transitive trust in a sense of A trusts B and B trusts C, then A can trust C. Well, nobody trusted America's Most Wanted because they didn't know who they were. They couldn't verify who they were. Well, all law enforcement agencies trust Inlets. Inlets trusted America's Most Wanted. Therefore, you could trust America's Most Wanted because of the intermediary Inlets. So that was the whole goal. That was, you know, basically transitive trust before it was built into blockchain, you know, years later. So, but that was the whole point, is that there was no trust with AMW because you couldn't prove who you were simply by calling in on an anonymous phone number and saying, hi, this is so-and-so from America's Most Wanted. And my first thought, if I'm some law enforcement agency, go, yeah, You're just a freaking bad guy wanting to know if we got any information on you. Not working.
Right, right.
Yeah. Hey, but I will tell you, let me tell you the one case, and I did a whole analysis of this. This is where it could have worked. You remember Ariel Castro? He kidnapped Michelle Knight, Gina. I'll think of all the names here in a minute, but Michelle Knight, Gina. I'll think of this here in a second, but he had kidnapped them, kept them for 10 years, you know, in the house. Mm-hmm. They had a sketch of him. In fact, I'll even send you that PDF too, the whole article and the analysis I wrote of it. When you compare his picture to the PDF, it's like, it's one of the best sketches I've seen of the actual suspect. And I've seen some weird sketches before. Gina DeJesus, Michelle Knight, and Amanda Berry. They're the three girls who were kidnapped by the piece of shit Ariel Castro, which he thankfully hung himself, saved the taxpayers a lot of money. But here's what the Cleveland police did not do. And I went back to every post that the Cleveland police made on their website, on Facebook. Not a single one was about this case. It was about, we have a horse unit and we're doing this. I get it. Great. But you know what? If I had targeted the neighborhoods where, by the way, all three girls were taken within a mile of each other. Did you know that? All three girls were kidnapped all within a mile of each other. And they were all being held within 3.5 miles of where they were kidnapped from. If I had just targeted the areas where those girls were taken from in those neighborhoods and said social media, and I said, hey, do you guys know this? Do you have a connection? I'm connecting people to this case because they lived in the areas where the girls were taken from. And if you took a 5 mile radius, you know, around that 5 to 10 mile radius, it would have hit every single neighborhood that Ariel Castro lived in, where he had his house at, that he stored the three girls at, and including the place where he was sighted kidnapping the one girl, Gina DeJesus. That's where they got the sketch out of him from. So I just look at all of these opportunities to actually have connected people to the case intelligently that we missed it. And the Cleveland kidnapping is a prime example of it.
So yeah, I'm super intrigued by this because, you know, we were kind of, with Truth and Justice, kind of innovators in this space 6 years ago, as far as in the podcast space using it. But the connection to the case for us, if we're looking for someone, the only thing I can rely on is sheer number of people that are listening. You know, so it's as simple as me saying, hey, I'm looking for this person in Houston. Does anybody know them? And it's shocking how often, you know, we'll get an email like, hey, my second cousin was married to him. Let me connect you to them. And then boom, 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 boom. And we find them pretty quickly. Having this technology out there, is it something that is out and available for people to interact with now?
No. What happened was, the first time is, it was a great idea. It actually worked. We had 50,000 users at one point, found missing people, you know, solved some crime, but it was difficult to figure out a business case for it. And I'll tell you the thing, I didn't learn the lesson that I learned this time, but it's the same bet that Mark Zuckerberg made with Facebook. The reason they bought Instagram, when you look at Snapchat, those are all mobile. I mean, really, Facebook anymore is mobile centric. Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, you know, everything is mobile centric. So before it was web based because, quite frankly, it was just too expensive to develop mobile apps, you know, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really wasn't there yet. But as they doubled down on the use of mobile, as we double down on what mobile apps can do, and now you can design things without having to have the full-blown native apps. There's a lot of hybrid apps that you can make now that will work both on Android and iOS. So what I'm doing now is actually working on, the key thing will be the structure, you know, behind the scenes, the database and how you collect the information. And then secondary, or along with that, will be the law enforcement dashboard. The law enforcement dashboard will still be web-based because you're going to have to at least do some data entry to begin with. But here's the funny thing about this, Bob. I don't need the permission of a law enforcement agency to add a case, because I'm not getting case. I don't need to know the weapon that was used. I don't need to know any of their holdback information. I don't need to know if, you know, blood was found at the scene or anything. You know what I need to know? Where did the homicide happen? Who's the person? What do I know about the person? Do we have a suspect? What do I know about the suspect? Anything that I could find on the web, anything that they would put out into a press release, is what goes into this system. So one of the biggest benefits for law enforcement is, they don't have to divulge criminal justice sensitive information. But on the other hand, is if I wanted to put the FBI top 10 in, which I've done before, you know, when I'm looking for a fugitive, when we had this up and running, I don't need the permission of them to do it. I can just put it in there and use open source research and find out everything I can about this person, you know, verify and vet some stuff. But again, date, location, time, demographics, relation is all, if, you know, Facebook can't connect us based on information it doesn't know about. It can only connect us based on information it knows about you and it knows about me. And then it connects us based on that. But if it doesn't know that I have a scar on my left arm, it can't connect based on that. So, but to connect you and me together, I mean, it's like if I were going after you, it's going to be very simple. I mean, you're a public figure. You got lots of information. Don't become a bad guy because I'll find you very easily. You'll be easy to find. You'll be asleep somewhere in a firehouse having a dinner. You were right. but what I'm saying is, but think about all the information that's out there about you. If I wanted to find you, I don't need law enforcement information.
So is it designed strictly to find like a known person? For example, we say that, you know, the police believe this person's responsible and they're trying to find them. Is it only for finding people or could it be used to find for anyone? Say you're just looking for people who have information about a crime.
Yeah. So that gets a little dodgy. Let me tell you what it can be used for. Missing juveniles, missing kids, people who are a danger to themselves. Mm-hmm. So endangered adults. It can also be used for cold cases. In fact, one of the best uses for this is cold cases to put information back in, cast a wide net, get people connecting to the website, sharing their social DNA, and finding out, do you have a connection to this cold case and generating leads, you know, new leads and tips. So it can be used for a variety of things. The thing you have to be careful of, and that's why but when the system gets up and fully running, a citizen just cannot come in and put in a case themselves and say, well, I'm looking for who's dating my girlfriend and I'm going to find this guy out. So I'm going to put a case in there. Yeah. You're not going to be able to do that. You know, it's got to be a verified, it's got to have a case number or it's got to be something that's well documented to the point of where we know that it's a valid, like FBI top 10, you know, DEA, US right. Marshals, you know, anybody like that, anybody, missing kids, you know, if you go into NAMIS, the national, missing, person system that they have built, you could pull out all of those cases because they all are documented. They're all been input by law enforcement. So, and that's public information. National Center for Missing Kids. I know John Clark, the executive director. In fact, one of the people that's in there is a case that I worked back when I was a detective. So she's still listed in the system. Rachel Pratt, 16 years old, went missing, never been found. No indication, probably, you know, dead most likely. But see, any of those cases that are out there that the public can find, it's just they've always organized it wrong, Bob. They've always said, hey, you go there, Bob, and you look through all of the system as opposed to, Bob, here's the easy button. Let me make it easy for you. I'm going to ask you one time just to go in and put in basic information, your zip code, all the zip codes where you've lived, where you've worked, you know, et cetera. Do it one time, and what I will do now is push information to you as it comes in. And if you have a connection to the case, feel free to pop the little button here and drop us a tip on the case. And that's, but then you get the big effect that you're talking about, the flywheel effect of where you can now you add the crowdsourcing you're doing along with targeted crowdsourcing like this. And now it just right. extends exponentially the reach you can have. Because somebody say, look, I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to share it with my friend. My friend decides to go put their information into the system. And now it makes a connection between my friend and the case. And voila, it's like an Amway thing. You get three and I get three. And pretty soon, you know, we all retire because we're rich.
Right. You know, that I'm thinking of the case that we just finished up with Truth and Justice, how it could be utilized in that. And that's it's a cold, you know, I work wrongful convictions, but it, you know, by definition for me, if it is in fact a wrongful conviction, then that means it's a cold case. And maybe not in the eyes of law enforcement, but in my opinion, they got the wrong person. So we're still trying to find who the right person is. And we have, you know, very little physical evidence to go right. on in this case, but it was at an apartment complex. And there was a bunch of teenagers at the complex that were kind of connected to it and involved. And, you know, I was trying like hell over the last, you know, several months trying to connect with, trying to find people that lived there just to hear, you know, what were people saying about it, who might have had a connection with it. And we had some success doing that. But I'm thinking that, or I'm wondering if like technology like this may be able to use those five factors to find people that maybe were living in that area and we're connected to some of the known people that were involved that might give us a list that we might be able to start, you know, using to contact.
So, you know, one of the ways it would be used on a case like that is obviously, you know, the date where it happened, you know, the location, you know, the time,
right.
you know, and then you start, you that becomes your case. So you create your case and you start putting the information in about the victim and the area that it happened and all those things. And then what you start doing is what will happen is the person with the information you may not connect directly with, but what you most likely will connect to is somebody who knows that person and says, hey, I know who was at that party because I was there, or I live here. Or guess what? Right. I used to live there. Now they get a push notification that says, Bob, you used to live at this apartment 2 years ago where this case happened at. Do you know anything about it? See, because a lot of people on their LinkedIn, on their social media profiles, also list places where they used to live. Like if you go into Facebook, it'll show, hey, I used to live here. So if you'll just simply go in, like we say, very simple. I don't even need your address. All I need is your zip code. Did you used to live in this zip code? Yeah, I lived here. 67846, Chapman, Kansas, or 67401. I think that was Salina, Kansas. You know, I can go back and think of all the zip codes where I've lived, you know, 20147. Mm-hmm. I can tell you 20147, which is Northern Virginia, Ashburn. It doesn't tell you where I live. It just tells you the area I'm in. But that's good enough. You know,
right.
People get wrapped up. I need GPS coordinates. No, you don't. What you need is just enough of a net that when I put it out there, you have a connection to that case because you both lived in the same zip code. Now, maybe you don't know the person. There's a lot of people I don't know that live in 20147. But I tell you this, though, if it happens around here, there's a good chance that I've heard about it. But what are the chances that I'm going to hear about a homicide on a place I was at vacation 2 years ago? You know, pretty minimal. But if I put in there that, hey, I was on vacation in, I went to Disneyland and we stayed, you know, in Orlando during the month of June of, you know, 2015. Well, what if there's a cold case from there and they say, you know, we know some of the people went to Disney. Well, you went to Disney, you were in Orlando at the same time. You'd get a push notification saying, hey, Bob, you may or may not know anything about this case, but you were here at the same time this happened. Do you know anything about the case? That's more information than what law enforcement has today. I can guarantee you. They would have no way of knowing all of the people who stayed in all of the hotels, you know, 2 years ago.
Sure. It's just fascinating, and it seems like it could be so effective. Is there a model, or do you foresee there being, like you said, nobody can just go in and put in their information. There obviously has to be some sort of data center that's entering in a case. Would there ever be a model where I could contact your company and say, hey, you know, I do this crowdsource podcast. This is the case. Here's the public data that we have on it. Could we enter this case and utilize that as part of our crowdsourcing? Is something like that ever a possibility, or would it be strictly something that would more so be used, the cases being entered by law enforcement?
You know, it depends, Bob. You know, it depends. If you know somebody that I know and, you know, we all know each other, you know, that's a good question because, you know, it always comes down to policy. So the question is, if there is an active law enforcement case and somebody, you know, it's easier to start off with what's easy to do. And what's easy to do is if it's an active case, missing person, or even if it's a cold case, I shouldn't say active case, but if it's a case that has a victim or a case number, and a lot of times you have a body, you don't know who the victim is, and you're trying to figure out, okay, we found a body here 10 miles south of town. Well, then the question comes is who was there around that area at that time that could have been 10 miles south of town, you know? So I don't know, but you know, but if it's like, especially like if it's a case where you're looking for witnesses, there could be some things like that. Yeah, that would make it easier to do. You know, I hadn't thought about that yet. I hadn't thought about exactly what my thought was. What you do is to, like anything else, you build something. You want to make sure it works first. You start off with the stuff that's easy, and that because at the end of the day, it's like America's Most Wanted. America's Most Wanted profiled people and went after people where there was cooperation from law enforcement, that there was an active case, right? So I know we can start with that. And then the question becomes, once we get that solved, in other words, let's solve the big problem first, like getting cooperation. Then it becomes, you know, here's what it could be too. It could be, Bob, you might have a long loss. And I have somebody I know that's sister lives in Ybor City down in outside Orlando there. Tampa. And mentally ill, you know, goes looking for, you know, needs to look for it. There are some humanitarian reasons that you would look for somebody. So I would just say the door is always open, but I think the first thing you got to do anytime you launch something like that is keep it small, solve the big problem first, you know, to make sure that it works, and then expand from there. But I could see different flavors of it being available for certain activities.
What's the law enforcement buy-in like? Do you have any pushback from, I'm presuming that you've at least pitched this idea to some law enforcement?
Oh, yeah.
Do you find there's more law enforcement buy-in, or is there more pushback, not one? Because, you know, I've kind of fought with this with what I do, and I've seen a shift both with attorneys and with law enforcement.
Right.
You know, when I started doing this in 2015, they're like, we don't want you private citizens. Get the hell out of here. You know, and then we go to these attorneys like, hey, I think we can help your client. And they're like, we don't do media. We don't want private citizens. Get out of here. And now we've got Incense Projects bringing us cases because they've started to see some value. Have you experienced that pushback, or do you feel there's more buy-in for what you're trying to do?
Well, I got pushback first because everybody thought, you know, well, we don't have cold cases, or, you know, we can find our own fugitives. And I'm like, well, you know, that's what a lot of people said. Then America's Most Wanted came along. And what was every law enforcement agency in the country trying to do? They wanted to get their case on TV. You know, they wanted to get their case up there, right? So one of the things I did, too, to kind of blunt that part of it is I worked very closely with Dana Schrod and the good people down at the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police. And I've already briefed the board at that time of the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police. That was a cross-section, I should say, of Virginia law enforcement from the state. I've met with the Bureau of Criminal Investigation commander at the Virginia State Police. He's all in on this. He loves the idea. Because when you look at the Association of State Criminal Investigative Agencies called ASHA, I mean, everybody wants to clear homicides, Bob. I mean, you do. You want to clear homicides. And the other thing, too, is I'm a big fan of putting the right person in jail for the homicide. You just don't clear a case because, oh, hey, look, this guy looks close enough. Close enough isn't good enough. Not when, at the end of the day, you put the wrong person in jail, it means the right person is still out there somewhere and potentially committed, and which we know they tend to commit more crimes. They never stop. You know, they usually end up committing more crimes.
Right. Yeah, that's great. And before we wrap things up, I mean, do you have a timeline? Do you have an idea of when this project may actually be up and running? I'm assuming it will be in a mobile form, like a mobile app.
Yeah.
Do you know when you're going to launch it?
No, not yet. And I'll tell you the reason being, too, a lot of this is, there's one good thing crowdsourcing is good for, too, and that's raising money. I've had a startup before and I've raised money and I made some mistakes doing that, and I'm not going to make the same mistakes this time. So it's a little bit more slow going. But, you know, part of it, too, is just really, it's raising the right amount of money to do the initial proof of concept, what's called minimum viable product, what's the MVP. But here's the thing about it. All of the risk has been taken out of it because it's already been designed before. And the other thing too, it's very easy to build. And I've worked with a couple of architects who do database design and stuff. Yeah, this is easy to build. You build it either on Amazon or on Microsoft. You build it in the cloud, you know, and then it stores it. It can analyze it. We can do all the analytics we want. It's really just about getting that initial design down. Now, that being said, then it's about proving it out. So even before you go to law enforcement, I think what you do is you get a few cases and you say, hey, look, we found your fugitive for you. We found this missing person for you. We've just generated eight tips for you on a cold case that you've been trying to solve. Here's eight new leads you didn't have before. So you have to provide some value. But the biggest pushback from law enforcement is initially going to be, and it is, it's anytime you start off a system, it's manual data entry until you figure out how to automate it, how to pull information out of their system, how to identify the information that you need so that it automatically populates, you know, an entry. But, you know, but that's what interns are for. That's what college students are for. They love this shit. I mean, they would love to be involved in saying, hey, you know, I want to help, you know, criminal justice students or other people say, hey, yeah, I want to help. We will volunteer and help enter these cases. Just give us the public help. Let get a bunch of people who are web sleuths do your open source investigation for you. The difference is it's structured. Here's the template we need for the suspect. Here's the template we need for the victim. Here's the template we need for the event. Go back, find information. Then you vet that information. You know, you verify that it's credible information. And then it goes into the case. And then the case is made active. And then the minute it is, you've got the DNA, the social DNA comparison between the known and the unknown. And anytime you get a hit, then you push a notification back to the user to say, hey, your information has been connected to a case. Boom. Then you also send a notification to law enforcement that, hey, we have somebody who's connected to your case. And then one of the things we had designed before that I'd need to build into this too is a secure communication system, one that provides anonymity for the tipster, but allows them to make contact with law enforcement because there are 640, I think, different websites for Crime Stoppers around the US and not one talks to the other. This is a way to disrupt completely how Crime Stoppers does business. Crime Stoppers is good in theory, but it's based on 50-year-old technology.
Gotcha. So do you have you started working on doing any crowdfunding for the project at this point?
No, it's been personally funded right now. And so I'm reaching my limits of that. So that's actually a really good question. You know, so part of the challenge is now that the initial patent is there, that was my first protection. Make sure the patent is there. And then start, and then the design, you know, the back end design. And then now a lot of that's been done. Now it's really going out and say, okay, now it's really about developing the portal for law enforcement to come in and enter their data. And then the mobile app for the end user.
Gotcha. Well, I wish you all the luck. I think it's an amazing concept. I'm really anxious to see it working. Hopefully it works as smoothly as that the system they were using on Clickbait. I mean, that was pretty slick. They found that guy pretty quick.
Human behavior, man. It's predictable. If you can figure out what people do, you can figure out how to catch them.
There you go. And I want to encourage all of you listeners to check out Morgan's podcast. It's called Game of Crimes. He is co-hosts with one of the subjects of Netflix Narcos. The show was based on Steve, Morgan's co-host, and his partner. Super interesting, great conversations. They cover some really, really intense cases and the people that were involved with them. So check out Game of Crimes. And Morgan, I really appreciate you coming on. And if you ever get this thing up and running, I want to have you back and let me know how it's working.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's always ways to collaborate. And I'll tell you what, this would be, to me, the basis of a brand new show. This would be America's Most Wanted on steroids. You get something like this working. It really goes beyond. Yep. Are you listening, Hollywood? Are you listening?
You know, you got to get with Jim Clemente. He's got all those people's ears.
Yep.
Because the key really is going to be to get user participation, right? You've got to get people to buy into it and put their information in there to make it work. So I hope it works out. I got a feeling that it's going to. I think it's a great concept. And Morgan, thanks so much for your time.
Sir.
Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com. where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. And I personally can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth, and Mike can be found @MurbGaming, MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.